Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Laura Stark from Vanderbilt University. This interview was a collaborative effort among myself and 40 undergraduates in the Vanderbilt course American Medicine and the World. For ideas and sample assignments on building the New Books Network into pedagogical practice, please send me an email. I'm talking today with Nancy Campbell about the important new book, OD, Naloxone and the Politics of Overdose, out in 2020 from MIT Press. Campbell is chair of department in science and technology studies at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, author of four previous books and numerous articles, and maker of many creative projects on technoscience, STS theory, and social justice. I suspect you'll appreciate this book if you're also a fan of Stephen Epstein's Impure Science on relations between HIV/AIDS activists, needle exchange networks, and federal scientists, Michelle Murphy's Seizing the Means of Reproduction on embodied evidence, Angela Garcia's Pastoral Clinic on the agency of landscape and place in addiction, Amy Hemrai's Building Access on the politics of expertise, and Joanna Radin's Life on Ice, exploring technoscience promises to manage time, its pause, and even its reversal. I hope you enjoy the interview. Professor Nancy Campbell, thank you so much for joining us and listeners of the New Books Network for our interview today. To give a bit of a context for listeners, this is a collaborative interview between me, Laura Stark at Vanderbilt University, and 40 undergraduate students in a course called American Medicine in the World. So we are collaboratively doing an interview with you, Nancy, and it's a delight to have you here. You are the chair of the Department of Science and Technology Studies at the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, and also the author of the new book, OD, Naloxone and the Politics of Overdose from MIT Press. So to give a bit more context, the book itself is about overdose and particularly focusing on the opioid drugs. Probably the best known among those four folks is heroin, and the most common form of administration is intravenous administration. And people might be familiar from things like the death of the actor Philip Seymour Hoffman, or closer to my own generation, the death of Kurt Cobain. But one of the things that you point out repeatedly in the book that's really useful in different historical moments is how this thing that bedevils the expert and policy communities, but is of course common knowledge for activist and user-led activist communities, which is the practice that's called stacking or polydrug overdose, which is that there's no easy, clear causal connection between overdose. And it's also highly environmentally, contextually specific as well, which is really interesting. So the book brings together questions of politics of evidence and expertise about activism and social movements and how they interact with expert communities. One of the things we really admired was that you don't have a really homogenous sense of activist or expert communities, that they're not caricatures, but you see activists and experts sometimes playing a role in each of these different positions and movements, which is really useful. And I think generous, really generous in a good way. And one of the key terms, phrases that comes up throughout the books is thinking of naloxone, which can counteract overdose, as a technology of solidarity. So the other big context with that in mind is that we're speaking on the first day of December in 2020, going into the first winter of the COVID-19 pandemic, in which we have no treatment or prevention in the form of a vaccine currently at any large scale. And many of the themes we found helped clarify and understand the COVID pandemic while looking at the opioid epidemic in this way. So things like stigma surrounding people's social practices, whether it's drug use or social contact or wearing a mask. Things like harm reduction strategies, whether it's good just to have people make things as you write, echoing a California-based activist movement, any positive change, or whether things like in the COVID pandemic, lockdown is what we should be going for, and how there are different patchy ways of responding to public health crises and potential death, and that how it's tremendously racially unequal. One of the other big themes and connections between reading this book about overdose and the opioid epidemic in some ways, and the COVID-19 pandemic is around policing. And so we wanted to start off by asking you to open up for us how the different earlier antidotes to overdose were used in the early 20th century, not to prevent deaths, but actually to police drug use. Can you talk about policing and overdose?
Yeah, so overdose, and I think you were thinking about technologies of suspicion, as I called them. I've been very interested in technologies of suspicion. You might know these as drug tests with your hair or with your saliva or sweat. And so I had written somewhat about technologies of suspicion long before I conceived of this book. This book grew out of my becoming familiar with what harm reduction activists were doing. And so I suppose it's not surprising that I tell a narrative arc that moves from when nalorphine, the first narcotic antagonist, was used as a technology of suspicion to this movement in the mid to late 1990s and early 2000s to use naloxone, in many ways, the second or the next narcotic antagonist to come down the pike, as a technology of solidarity. So I have been very interested in the activists' enrollment of the first responders, including law enforcement, in the use of naloxone, because they were often first on the scene of an overdose. And so they had the most agency in determining how an overdose would be handled. And the activists often had to really get over their own distance from and resistance to the police, to the sheriff's department. My own sheriff's department here in Rensselaer County started carrying naloxone in 2012, and they were one of the first sheriff's departments in the entire country to carry naloxone, and that was because there was a series of overdose deaths in a high school, a rural high school, about, I would say, maybe 10 miles from where I live in Troy, New York. And so they had begun carrying naloxone. But of course, police carrying anything can raise suspicion, and it can kind of raise the temperature of any incident or event. And so it's been very interesting to me to see how people have to kind of do their own little journey, moving from technologies of suspicion to technologies of solidarity, in order to understand what's happening with naloxone today. Now, today in my own county, you can get curbside delivery. So back to what Professor Stark was saying earlier about the way in which the pandemic, I kind of think of it like the caduceus, right? The pandemic and the overdose epidemic kind of wind around each other like those two reptiles in the caduceus. And in my own county, overdose deaths in 2020 still outstrip COVID-19 deaths in 2020. And so there is a way in which a lot of the harm reduction tactics that I write about in OD are not well suited to a situation like the pandemic. So the technologies of solidarity in a lot of ways don't suit the condition of social isolation that we all find ourselves in today. And what's always interesting to me about harm reduction is that typically people come up with other ways of doing things. They're pretty resourceful and they figure out how to get curbside delivery of naloxone, and they figure out how you can do that without, coming into contact with other people. And so I think that in some ways the movement can do that, but in other ways there's a kind of material stop to that, which is that you really, although there are some people who say you can use naloxone on yourself, you really aren't in a frame of mind typically to self-administer naloxone. And so if you truly are alone, it is the harm reduction tenet. The first tenet really is never use alone. And yet how many of us are in that situation where we are spending a lot more time alone than we used to. So in some ways, technologies of solidarity are just not well suited to where we are now. And so we will have to think of other ways to respond to the twinned kind of nature of the epidemics.
The story of naloxone is also so interesting because you show how even when these earlier forms of antidote, of remedy, were being used in policing to police drug use in the earlier 20th century, these technologies then were used among scientists, but they were really interested in trying to understand brain chemistry and neurobiopsychiatry and these sorts of things, not directed towards seeing it as a life-saving technology. And then the naloxone was approved by the FDA in 1971. Am I remembering that correctly?
That's right.
And even then it was still sequestered within experts' communities, although there started to be patchy groups of activists who were the ones who were creating this embodied evidence and the embodied forms of knowledge around the fact that naloxone could be used to address an overdose and to avoid a death in an overdose. And what you show is how some of the tactics and strategies of other activist movements really helped these smaller groups working in California, in Chicago, in Boston, Massachusetts, coming out of the HIV/AIDS activism organizations, really knitted with broader harm reduction activist groups, including folks who were interested in overdose and working against overdose. So here I'm going to hand the mic over to Maya to follow up on activist communities and HIV/AIDS groups that you address in the book, Nancy.
Thank you so much again for being here today. So you mentioned earlier how things have kind of changed with the pandemic and how certain harm reduction strategies have had to readjust. And we've seen a current uprise in drug use and drug-related overdoses with the pandemic. So we were wondering if any of the harm reduction strategies have helped fix this or ameliorate the drug use issues and the drug overdose, and what strategies have been put in place to overcome the barriers that come with the pandemic?
It's really interesting. I think we're still waiting. Well, no, I guess we have seen a few, maybe you have your own favorites, sardonic or kind of commentary on the way in which the pandemic is being handled. One of the things that the HIV/AIDS movement did particularly well, I think, was it tapped into a vein of humor, of you might call it gallows humor, you might find it, but it was irreverent, and it was often really in your face. And so one of the joys of this particular book is that about half of the illustrations in the book are from a zine that was made by Santa Cruz Needle Exchange. And in it, they really, I think, took that, pushed what I just said to an extreme. And so sometimes I think that's pretty important. In this epidemic, there has been, of course, a lot of emphasis on public health. There has been a lot of politics around what we should or should not do in terms of public health. And there hasn't been much room yet, I think, for a movement to come along like the HIV/AIDS movement or even the women's health movement. Before the HIV/AIDS movement, and one of the things that I was sorry I didn't get a chance to do a little more was think about that in terms of the women's health movement, because I do think that this matter of people taking into their own hands their matters of health, matters of the body, these are not as coming forward in this epidemic as are the more official, public healthy kinds of ways of thinking and doing things. And so I kind of missed that. And I hope that that will eventually happening. Not that it shouldn't be taken seriously, but that many young people and many people who are disbelieving about the realities of the situation might benefit from a little bit more, a lighter touch, and a little bit more laced with humor in the ways that the Santa Cruz Needle Exchange materials were really giving us.
In chapter six in particular, Nancy, we really, really admired your use of visual evidence as a historian to show how these California groups, and I think it was specifically the Santa Cruz group, was doing peer education, and to think about how education is a could be done in community terms, not an individual intervention to necessarily change a person's behavior because it was wrong. So thinking about the use of zines in the early 90s, for the sort of peer education, and particularly sort of this aesthetic of harm reduction and this this sardonic style you're talking about really coming through in the images that you show in the book of junk food, food spelled P-H-O-O-D. And so to follow up on this, I want to hand the mic over to Jeanette.
Hello. Thank you again so much for being here. So like Professor Stark said, in chapter six, you do talk about zines like junk food and how harm reduction activists use those to educate drug users about overdose and naloxone. So I was wondering, in all of your time studying OD and naloxone and all of that, have you seen like a change, especially now that we're in the digital age, have you seen like a change in how activists have you seen a change in how activists approach harm reduction, especially with the recent gains and losses in the harm reduction movement?
Yes. So the advent, obviously, of the internet did mean that activists in some ways had an easier time of getting material out. But there's a tremendous backlog of visual material. I'm on Instagram, and I subscribe to Ward 5B, which is a channel that centers very early kind of from Stonewall forward, gay, lesbian, bi, trans liberation type graphics. And some of that is part of the HIV AIDS movement story, but some of that is much more, it's much beyond the sort of public health story. So what I was really interested in was the way in which these activists in San Francisco, in Santa Cruz, in Chicago, the Chicago Recovery Alliance did a lot of this. They had to invent their own protocols, and overdose prevention education really did come out straight out of this harm reduction movement. They were trying to figure out how to keep each other safe and how to intervene if one of them did get into an overdose situation. And so it was really an interesting interaction also with scientists and researchers who were ethnographers or doing what I would call shoe leather ethnography. They were really working directly with the people that they were who were their informants, I suppose. And so I had been very curious about historical generations of ethnography, as a kind of almost art aesthetic, as a means of expression. And so I had written about that before. And so I do think that there's been changes in terms of who uses much more what we might say gritty realism versus groups that are using less realistic, often science fiction or speculative fiction oriented aesthetics, as did Santa Cruz Needle Exchange. And the Harm Reduction Coalition and these are international now and national organizations that have created whole new kind of genres like harm reduction photography. I was very honored to be able to include in the book a photograph of Dan Bigg taken by Nigel Brunsdon, who's a British harm reduction photographer. And he does such a variety of work that it has his signature, really, but it's very different kinds of work. So yeah, I've been privileged, I would say honored, to watch the movement change. The movement is very sophisticated in certain ways around political framing and around how harm is represented and constructed. And that has changed over time considerably, so that it's much more better integrated today in a way with public health messaging than it was in the early days. So it's really been interesting to watch it, in a sense, mature.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
The book documents so nicely how things like visual evidence and individual anecdotal evidence. So for example, I especially want to flag for listeners that the book also does comparative work with the UK, and particularly looking at sort of the exemplar case of Scotland. And in these cases, cases, there are there's a priority given to different forms of evidence. And also hearkening back to your own comments, Professor Campbell, about the women's health movement and your own references in the book to Michelle Murphy's work on counter practices and seizing the means of reproduction. So thinking about what counts as evidence and what can convince, for example, evidence-based policymakers, as opposed to what convinces people in peer-to-peer education, and how the randomized control trial still continues to present a real challenge against which the forms of illness and potential death that don't fit into RCT protocols, either for ethical reasons or because the fabricated categories of RCTs don't work in these contexts. So thinking about these historical receptions of different forms of images and of stigma. And another really key thing we want to also point out here is the racialized presentation of the disease, where, as you write, it always seems to be a surprise that white communities are involved because of this, which is not true, that it has not always been the case, because of the stigma surrounding drug use and drug overdose. And so here I want to hand the mic over to Olivia.
Thank you. So like Dr. Stark said, our group was really interested in the idea of stigma. And we were wondering if you think that historical perceptions of drug use culture still affect those who who suffers the most from preventable overdose deaths today? And further, do you think this stigma detrimentally affects the grieving process of those who lose someone to a drug-related death?
Definitely, I do. So I've been very interested in what I've called in another work, the cultural repository of imagery around drug use, drug addiction, even the term addiction itself. Which continues, one of my books was about the way in which doctors and researchers, clinicians who worked with people who use drugs, tried as early as the 1920s to destigmatize opioid use, and particularly to disconnect drugs and crime from one another so that drug addicts were not seen solely as criminals, but also as patients. And so this work has both succeeded and failed over and over. We have tried to really engage the problem of stigma, which is suspected to and really has been shown to increase shame and other parts of the cycle that keep people locked into behaviors that are clearly very bad for them and their relationships. And so so I think stigma is a very big part of the picture. And I think that it's very interesting that we know that, and yet we somehow keep reproducing it. That's how I started thinking about Michelle Murphy's work on reproduction. So the I wanted to tell you about the first part of your question. Could you repeat it again? Because it's the phrase kind of fled out of my head.
Absolutely. So the first part of our question was whether or not you think historical perceptions of drug use culture still affect which groups suffer the most from preventable overdose deaths.
Yes. So I wanted to also talk, but to say very clearly that it has been white people who have by far been the majority, particularly of opioid users, since the 19th century. Okay, so the women, white women who looked like me, white upper and middle class women were the majority of opioid users in the 19th century. The United States was the world's most voracious consumer of opioids, which have been produced. Morphine was synthesized in 1805. And of course, there was a massive colonial apparatus to get opioids spread all across the globe. And our country was one that was a real consumer of these products, which showed up, of course, in proprietary and patent medicines as well. So from that point forward, the racialization of the opioid epidemic should have been white. But beginning in the attempts to get the Harrison Act, which passed in 1914 and which effectively criminalized narcotics, there began to be a racialization, a popular racialization, as if African Americans and people from communities of color had access to opioids, which historically they didn't. And in fact, needles and syringes were not really available until after World War II. So right after World War II, there's an intense racialization of heroin in particular, but opioids generally. And that would include white ethnic individuals. So Puerto Rican and even Jewish folks in New York were often understood to be using opioids. So this racialization really catches hold and becomes very pronounced and pointed in the 1970s. And then, of course, as you all probably know, in the 1980s, crack cocaine comes along and really heightens that effect. Even though it's not an opioid, it really heightens the effect of racialization and the criminalization, and therefore the stigmatization of drug use more generally. So these kinds of patterns have made overdose endemic in communities of color and less endemic in white communities, even though it was often white people who were dying because drug markets were located within urban communities of color. So what we are seeing today is very different in that the effect on small cities, on cities that are more white than not in the Midwest, et cetera, right, suddenly have access to opioids and to needles and syringes that they did not have before. And so those kinds of population shifts were very hard to trace in this book because of the stigma surrounding opioid overdose. Many times opioid overdose wasn't mentioned on death certificates, and cities did not keep track of it. You've probably all run into the situation where people are said to, quote, die in their sleep. And those are often opioid overdoses, but they would never be trackable on a death certificate. So one of the reasons I turned to Scotland, to get back to that question about the more comparative frame of the book, was because they too have a very high, unfortunately, overdose death rate, and they were a majority white kind of population. And so I wanted to make that kind of comparison very clear.
The way in which you use Scotland as a case to think alongside the United States in naloxone as a technology of solidarity really goes to show also the form that your research took and how important it is for historians to be doing the sorts of research that is in addition to institutional research, and in addition to work that assumes that the cause of social justice is something to aspire towards in the future, which it is, and yet also there are these little patches of communities doing this kind of work in ways that creates traces and forms of historical evidence that fall out of the historian's very orthodox apparatus of detection as well. And you're really getting at these so nicely in the book and documenting in new ways these little patches of solidarity and how it's operating. And building on the question of destigmatizing overdose, I'm going to hand the floor to Samara.
Hello. Thank you so much for being here. So what I was wondering, and I know a lot of other students in class was wondering, was how can we as students contribute to destigmatizing the conversation around overdose and best support methods of recovery that reduce harm against users?
Wow. Well, I'm glad to hear that you are thinking about that. So one of the things, since you're all obviously college students, that I have been interested in is how many of the people I ended up interviewing for the book were people who ended up becoming very much what I would call evidence-based activists. So people who know how to write, who know how to present information, who know how to document, who know how to produce statistical analyses, often quite sophisticated statistical analysis. They ended up educating themselves in order to do this work, right? So they enter into evidence-based activism, many of them critical of evidence-based medicine being the only way to really conduct oneself. But now you can look all across our country and you see in public health departments, you see people who have entered policy specifically to begin to reduce harm. There seem to be so many ways in which the energy of individuals goes into this kind of collective effort. Can we, as a society, reduce the harm of opioids? I mean, opioids are totally necessary. They're essential medicines. They are likely to be with us for a very long time unless we can figure out viable alternatives. And so I would say figure out viable alternatives and figure out how to get messages further out to the public. In some ways, some of the most effective work that I've seen comes from people like yourselves who are basically saying, we have to stop othering the drug user, right? These are people who use drugs and who have similar values and similar ways of life as to our own. And so to the degree that you can humanize, make compassionate, and emphasize the human rights of people who are involved in these kinds of practices and behaviors, I think that could go a long way towards doing the other things that we clearly need to do in terms of destigmatization, making sure that people do know how to use naloxone and how to carry naloxone. Naloxone won't be the last, I would say, harm reduction product out there. We are all harm reductionists now in the midst of this epidemic. And so figuring out what's going to be your style of that, your brand, your practices, your ways of organizing your lives in order to reduce harm and negative consequences, wherever and however possible for you and the people who you consider your community, I think that's very important work, and there's really a lifetime of it in front of you. So thank you for that question.
One of the things that your answer also really points out, Nancy, is something that we've talked a lot about in this class in other contexts, which is that one of the most important things that people can perhaps do to work in destigmatizing overdose and thinking about drug-related lives as sort of the vocabulary that you give us in the book as well, is just to think clearly and to help other people think clearly about why some forms of evidence are taken seriously in some contexts and some are not. And so when we hear folks or see folks or read folks not taking seriously people's stories as a form of evidence, think about the challenges and the orthodoxies of these more statistical dominant forms of evidence creation that aren't the only forms. They tend to be more just the expert medicalized community form, but the, you so nicely show how the peer communities are really collecting important forms of evidence that might not fit so easily, but capture the situation much more accurately, much more aptly.
And so, yes, they're also trying to figure out how to frame evidence and frame their claims in ways that people can identify with them and can hear them.
Thinking about the future for overdose and what this might look like, I'm going to have Isabella take it away.
Hi. So one way naloxone has been normalized for me personally is by having naloxone training in my high school health class. And then thinking about the future of naloxone and how to achieve widespread naloxone acceptance and use, we have sort of a slew of questions around this topic because we know that that isn't normalized across the United States. So what do you think about implementing naloxone training in high school? Do you think it would make a difference? Do you think it would be possible given the legislative work that must be done to amend school curriculums? And then lastly, do you think that there's a chance we will ever see naloxone knowledge and use become as destigmatized as teaching, for example, a CPR class in a high school?
I think we might be heading towards that. It's interesting. I think it was Clara who said earlier, talked about pricing of naloxone. And the one of the big problems, naloxone's an old drug, as you probably understand by now, the approval being almost 50 years ago at FDA. And yet the naloxone delivery devices are quite expensive. And so in order for naloxone and really harm reduction overdose prevention to become normalized in high schools is if they can afford it. And so I think we will need to watch for something that's a little bit more like a public health oriented or public interest pharmaceutical model. So that would bring down the price of naloxone to the point where more school districts could in fact afford it. Even public health departments are going to have a difficult time affording it now that they're putting so much resources into COVID-19 containment. And so this is a question of both resources and willingness and motivation. And so there are many people who frame harm reduction as condoning illegal behavior. And so there will always be, I think, in high schools in particular, groups that will oppose harm reduction because they will equate it with condoning. You must have gone to a very a high school in which that was not the case, or a high school in which people had begun to realize that they better do something because a lot of our young people are, in fact, and actually a lot of people my age, like late 40s and early 50s, are unfortunately dying of opioid overdose to the point where longevity among those ages in this country has declined considerably. And so I think that your question is a really interesting one. And I would love to know where you come from, that you're getting overdose prevention training in high school. But I think it needs to happen in so many places. And I think the other thing that brings up is the unevenness, which someone noted a little bit earlier in our conversation, the unevenness of where is naloxone and where are opioids. These are very local epidemics. And our nationalized kind of discourse does not really pay sufficient attention to how localized these are. For instance, we all hear a lot about fentanyl. Now, there has been a fentanyl overdose epidemic in Estonia for 20 years. And we didn't have one here until 2013. Beginning in 2013, you see a huge increase in fentanyl overdose deaths. And you know what? Most of those, that's exactly what accounts for the rise in African American overdose deaths, is that influx of fentanyl into the U.S. heroin supply and stimulant supply in 2013. And so now I think we face a really different picture, a really different problem, right, where we must make naloxone at least as available as we've made fentanyl. And we have managed to make fentanyl so available and so ubiquitous, right, that now we better do the same with naloxone.
I love that challenge. That's such a great parallel, Nancy. That's a great, gosh. Just to wrap up, the book really is also interesting and important for us to read because of the way that you figure yourself as a partisan in the discussion, and yet also a trustworthy, clear-eyed observer, and in direct dialogue with the reader. So really encouraging the reader to think through these questions in these ways. And on some of the final pages, you actually address the reader directly, and I'm going to quote you here, where you say, "Where did you start to feel ambivalent as a reader of this book about naloxone as a technology of solidarity?" And that's the end of the quote. And then seeing how you are thinking about social justice yourself and trying to work on this book, both as a hard-nosed historian, but also as someone who is a hard-nosed historian with a project of social justice in mind. And so here I'm just going to close with your final sentences, in which you invoke a line from one of the activist organizations, the Chicago Recovery Alliance, about any positive change. And you write, "Harm reduction is a broad approach that may be adapted to prevent many kinds of social suffering through close attention to the people, places, and things that matter. Starting from what matters most, change the world to reduce harms that we know well. Any positive change will make us more human." And I just thought that was beautiful and really nicely written. So thank you so much for this fantastic book and for your generosity with this conversation today.
Well, you're very welcome. And I want to just say, any positive change has become a bit of a mantra in the harm reduction movement. Dan Bigg credits that line to the person who galvanized him into action, the death of his friend, John Zeiler. And so I think it's important. It's an important way of talking to one another to just support any positive change.
Thank you.